Yo, yo, yo! What is going on, Energy Fam? Welcome back to the next episode of Primal Alchemy's Red Pill Initiation Hour, here with your host, Chris Story. First things first, guys, let's touch base. I want to give a massive thank you and show some appreciation to each and every one of you for first, dropping by and giving me a few hours of your day to listen to me. Second, for all the continuous love and support that you guys show me at the end of each and every episode. I keep asking you guys if you could just drop me some feedback, anything, any little bit of feedback, be it positive or negative, let me know. Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, YouTube, whatever medium it is that you're using to listen to me now. At the end of this podcast, just hit me up. Drop me a comment, drop me a message. And just let me know what you think. Again, your feedback is critical for me, guys. I want to make this as beneficial and as valuable for you as possible. I want to bring you the best guests. I want to give you the best woke as fuck information. And I want to help you evolve physically, mentally, and spiritually. I just need a little bit of feedback from you guys to let me know that I'm on the right path with this one, to let me know that what I'm saying is making some form of impact. Big or small, that's all I want to know. And as a massive thank you for doing that, guys, I always drop you the exclusive 10% discount code Red Pill. That's the code Red Pill that, when used at checkout at primalalchemy.co.uk, you'll get 10% off anything within your shopping basket at the time of purchase. If you're brand new to the Primal Alchemy brand, guys, and this is the first time tuning in, then why not jump on primalalchemy.co.uk straight after and check out our Vitruvian protein? That's our flagship organic whey protein superfood blend. It's forged with adaptogenic herbs, nootropics, prebiotics, high vibrational superfoods from around the world, and the ultimate P4P GOAT health supplement of the third dimension. Quite the claim, but you gotta try it, guys. So why not give it a go now? Use the code Red Pill and get 10% off your Vitruvian protein at primalalchemy.co.uk. I'm also coming at you guys with another exclusive offer just for you, and that's from my bro Josh at APE Nutrition. APE Nutrition manufacture the UK's only organic ketogenic protein bar. That's formulated with only the best earth-grown organic ingredients. And this stuff is delicious, guys. You don't want to know how many I've consumed in the past previous few weeks. Fuck. I could smash boxes upon boxes if I was a millionaire. All in due time, though, guys. So, yes, if you use the code PRIMALAPE, that's the code PRIMALAPE, you will get 10% off your purchase at apenutrition.co.uk. So check the website out, give my brother Josh some love. Really, really good brand, solid guy, and yeah, we're all in this to succeed together and change the world together. Save yourself, save the world. That's what we're about. So yes, check it out. Anyway, guys, moving on to today's episode. Ooh, we're hitting the big time, guys. I remember when I had my first doctor on the show. Well, this time we're evolving. We got the first professor on the show. You heard that right. Professor. So, yeah, today's guest is Professor Donald Hoffman. Donald is a professor in the Department of Cognitive Sciences at the University of California, Irvine. And I stumbled across Donald's work watching a few videos uploaded by Science and Non-Duality, which is a YouTube channel that uploads some pretty interesting shit. And Donald was given a talk about simulation theory, reality being a user interface. He's got a new book coming out soon called The Case Against Reality: How Evolution Hid the Truth from Our Eyes. Yeah, you guys know by now that I have some pretty far out views, and I talk about simulation theory a lot. I talk about the world, the universe itself being a sort of a spiritual virtual reality that our consciousness is kind of plugged into our bodies, and our body is like an avatar. It's like a MMORPG character that we are playing this life through. And yeah, Donald's on the same page. He might not be as well versed as I am in the geeky lingo and being able to reference Elder Scrolls and Fallout and all of these other games, but he is quite the maestro when it comes to the actual science behind this. And yeah, it was a fascinating talk, guys. I really enjoyed it. I kind of just sat there and absorbed everything that Donald was having to say, and I was kind of in my head just processing it, trying to make it relevant to what sort of fragments of knowledge that I understood from the physics that he was discussing, from the mathematics he was discussing. And yeah, it ties in so nicely to a lot of the ancestral wisdom that I've studied for years on end. And I think definitely onto something with this one. So let's just jump straight into it. I really hope you enjoy this one, guys. Let me know what you think afterwards. Time to get woke as fuck. Morpheus, tell these fools what's up.
You take the blue pill, the story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill, you stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
As above, so below, what lies without resides within. Time for growth to begin. Mental, physical, and spiritual. We find balance with all three as we focus on totality. The whole, not the half. This is for those on a spiritual path. Looking for the clues to the answers of life. But the truth ain't always nice, so leave your ego at the door. Let your inner lion roar and your spirit soar as we go deep down to the molecular level. Tap into the body with some yogic breath. Throw in some calisthenics for a true strength test. Like the shamans of old, we use in nature to heal. With a little bit of DMT to reveal. This whole life journey is a little surreal. And your mind needs a leader, not a follower in life. Let your mind be the master and you pay a hefty price. This next 60 minutes is about self-mastery. It's not an easy path and it's a lifelong journey. But we up to empower with this red pill initiation hour. With this red pill initiation hour, brought to you by Primer Okami.
The Matrix is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth.
Three, two, one, and oh shit, Sweet Osiris. Guys, we are back with episode 36. Of the Red Pill Initiation Hour. Now, guys, this one, you know, you probably hear me say it every single episode that this one's going to be the one, this one's going to be the one that blows your mind, but this one is going to be the one to blow your mind, guys. I'm telling you, we are in for quite the gift on this one. Really going to be a real mind-opening, consciousness-expanding discussion of something that you guys know by now is a big interest of mine. You know, if you've listened to my first episode, that I went in deep on the simulation theory, and there is much more to this universe behind the scenes than meets the eye. And yeah, I've managed to get on the perfect guest today in order to break this down for us and take us on the trip out of the Matrix itself. So yeah, this one's really looking forward to this one. And yeah, I just want to give a massive warm welcome to the guest himself. He is the architect of the Matrix. It is Professor Donald Hoffman. Don, thanks for coming on, my man.
Thank you very much for having me, Chris. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, and like I was just telling you briefly before we started, Don, like, this whole experience, it's very surreal for me because I've watched your videos for a few years now. I loved your talks on the science of non-duality, on that sort of thread on YouTube. I've watched little interviews you've done here and there. And yeah, just yourself and some of the other sort of players within that sort of field of thought. Yeah, you guys have interested me for such a long time. And I come from quite a, I guess, like a diverse background in that I have an interest in the science that you guys are doing, but then I'm also very interested in the sort of esoteric mysticism side of things as well. And you guys are really putting in the work to confirm a lot of the stuff, maybe not at face value, but there's a lot of things that you guys are coming up to, like conclusions that you're coming at reaching with your research, that it's starting to show a lot of familiarity and mirror very closely a lot of what I've been interested in with ancient civilizations, ancient cultures, sacred texts, and yeah, the all the stuff to do with mysticism for the past few thousand years, the messages that's been brought to us from there. So Don, if you wouldn't mind, could you give us a bit of a rundown for everyone who's not familiar with who you are and what your work is? Just get us up to scratch with who the big architect in the room is.
Well, I'm at the University of California at Irvine, in the Department of Cognitive Sciences. I'm a professor there, and I've been working on visual perception, mathematical models of how we see and how we see colors and objects in three dimensions. And I've also been very interested then in understanding how human consciousness and consciousness more generally works, and trying to understand what's called the hard problem of consciousness. How are our conscious experiences related to brain activities? And trying to develop mathematical models of consciousness and its relationship to the physical world. And so that's the general area I've been working in. And I've been trying to grapple with the hard problem of consciousness because my colleagues in the cognitive neurosciences who are working on it are assuming that brain activity somehow causes our conscious experiences. And we have lots of empirical evidence of correlations between neural activity in the brain and our conscious experiences. For example, correlations between area V1 of visual cortex in the brain and our experiences of light and vision. Area V4 and experiences of color. Area MT and our experiences of motion and visual motion. And so we have hundreds of correlations like those, and the question is to get a scientific theory to explain the precise relationship between our conscious experiences and neural activity in the brain. And right now we have no plausible theories about how brain activity could cause conscious experiences, and no plausible ideas about how that could happen. And so I've been trying to reverse the direction, instead of saying brain activity causes conscious experiences, to ask maybe conscious experiences are fundamental, and perhaps somehow our experience of space and time and physical objects, including the brain, derive from conscious experiences and not vice versa. And so my work has been looking at that different direction. Instead of starting with brain and getting consciousness, starting with consciousness and showing how we can get space-time, matter, and neural activity coming out as some kind of a representation, an interface that we use to consciousness. And one of the directions that I've been pursuing on this is first to ask a question that's sort of pertinent to my colleagues. Most of my colleagues assume that neural activity causes our conscious experiences. And in that regard, one of the reasons they say that is that they think that neurons exist, even if they're not observed, and that neurons have causal powers. And that seems like a very obvious assumption and no problem, but that's what I've been questioning, is our assumption that space, time, and physical objects, including neurons, exist even if they're not observed, if there were no living creature to observe them, have causal powers, even if there are no creatures. And so I've been looking at it from the point of view of evolution by natural selection. I'm taking one of our best confirmed scientific theories and asking, would evolutionary pressures shape us to see reality as it is? So that the predicates of space and time and physical objects would be the right predicates, the right language to describe reality. And what I and my colleagues, for example, Chetan Prakash and others have found is that if our senses evolved and were shaped by natural selection, the probability is really zero that any of our perceptions describe reality as it is. So the idea that comes out of this is that space, time, and physical objects as we perceive them, our senses are not giving us a picture of the truth. They're doing something very different. They're just giving us little symbols that we need to stay alive, much like symbols on your desktop of your computer, right? The icons on your desktop aren't telling you the truth about what's inside the computer. I mean, the icons tend to have colors like, you know, blue icon that's rectangular in the middle of your screen, say for a paper that you're writing or an email that you're crafting. That doesn't mean that the paper or the email inside your computer is blue or rectangular or in the middle of the computer. That's not what an interface is for. It's not there to describe the truth. It's there to help you control the truth, whatever that might be, even though you're ignorant of that reality, of that truth. And that's what it seems like evolution has done for us. It's given us space and time as our desktop and physical objects as icons within that interface. And so the reason I went after that, it was a preliminary problem I had to solve before I jump into the question of consciousness and its relationship to the physical world. Because the assumption of my colleagues has been that the physical world exists even if there are no creatures to perceive it. And what I'm saying is that assumption is contradicted by one of our best scientific theories, namely evolution by natural selection. If evolution by natural selection is a correct model of how our senses evolved, then the chance is zero that space, time, and physical objects, as we perceive them, in any way reflect the true nature of objective reality. Those are just a species-specific user interface that's evolved to hide the reality, whatever it might be, and let us control that reality, even though we're ignorant about its true nature. And so one special consequence of that is that no physical objects have genuine causal powers. They're just our symbols. They're not pre-existing entities that have causal powers. And that includes neurons. So the assumption of my colleagues that somehow neural activity creates our conscious experiences contradicts evolution by natural selection. Both cannot be true. So we have to make a choice. And so I'm choosing to let go of the idea that space, time, and physical objects, as we perceive them, are true reflections of the nature of objective reality. I'm accepting the verdict of evolution by natural selection and saying that objects are just our icons. They're something that we create as representations, effectively, of the fitness payoffs that we need to get to stay alive and reproduce. And so that turns the whole question of perception and reality and consciousness on its head. Neurons aren't the foundation. They're just symbols that we create. They don't exist independent of observers. They're the product of observers. They're some of the symbols that observers use. And so that turns the whole question of consciousness and its relationship to the physical world around. So that's where I'm starting, but I should probably stop and let you jump in and say whatever you'd like to at this point.
Yeah, no, I'm really interested in what you were saying then. It's very kind of coincides with, I guess, like the observer effect. Mm-hmm. And it's that age old saying, I guess, of like, if a tree falls in the forest and no one is around, does it make a sound? Is that kind of getting at?
Absolutely. It's addressing that very same question. And the answer that's coming out of evolution by natural selection is the tree didn't exist if there were no creatures to observe it, nor did the space-time in which we thought the tree would exist. Even the space-time itself doesn't exist independent of us. So our idea that space-time somehow came into existence 13.8 billion years ago in the Big Bang and existed for hundreds of millions of years before any living creatures came around and certainly before any consciousness came around, that whole picture has to be wrong, deeply wrong. Mm-hmm. Space and time are not the pre-existing stage in which the drama of life plays out. Rather, they are data structures that certain conscious agents, Homo sapiens, happen to use to represent fitness payoffs and how to get them.
When you say fitness payoffs, what does that mean? Sorry.
That's a great question. Evolution by natural selection can be understood pretty well in terms of thinking about video games. In a video game, right, you have to be very focused on grabbing points. Mm-hmm. And looking for points and getting them as quickly as you can. If you do anything except hunt and grab points as fast as you can, you'll die. And you won't get to the next level of the game. But if you get enough fitness points, then you can get to the next level of game where it gets even harder and more fun. In evolution, it's sort of the same way. There are fitness payoffs, according to evolutionary game theory, that we have to collect. And if we get enough of these fitness payoffs, such that we get more than our competitors, then we can survive and reproduce and have more offspring that have the same strategy for collecting fitness payoffs that we had. So it's not that you get to the next level of the game, but that you pass on your genes and your offspring are sort of the next level of the game. And so it's about different strategies for collecting fitness payoffs. And different creatures will have different strategies. And the payoffs will differ from organism to organism. For example, for me, it would be a bad strategy to decide to go 5,000 meters underwater. That's a really bad move for me. That would kill me. Whereas for a benthic fish, that's a great strategy. That's where it's going to survive. For me, eating a bite of dark chocolate is great. For my cat, eating that same dark chocolate could kill it. Or my dog, the same thing. A T-bone steak is great for a hungry lion to eat. It's not great for a rabbit, and it's not great for a cow. So, if the lion is not hungry and wants to mate, well, that T-bone steak really doesn't offer it any fitness payoffs. And so, one of the coin of the realm in evolution are these fitness payoffs, and they depend on the true state of the world, whatever the world might be, objective reality might be, but they also depend on the organism, like lion versus big fish versus me, and the state, hungry versus sated, for example, and the action, feeding, fighting, fleeing, mating, and so forth, those various actions that we can take. And so these fitness payoffs are really complicated functions, and in some sense, the point of the evolutionary game is to grab a few more fitness points than your competition, and that allows you to survive long enough to reproduce and have your genes passed, that code for your strategies being passed into the next generation. And when you can make what I've just said mathematically precise. There's something called the replicator equation in evolutionary game theory. So everything that I've been talking about can be made absolutely mathematically precise. And so we've done that. We've simulated it, and we've actually looked at proving theorems based on evolution by natural selection. And the result is straightforward. An organism that sees reality as it is never more fit than an organism of equal complexity that sees none of reality and instead just sees or perceives the fitness payoffs somehow. Mm-hmm. So seeing the truth will drive you extinct. It won't set you free. It'll drive you extinct.
Wow.
And that's the result of evolution by natural selection. And so what this entails is that our perceptions of space and time and physical objects are not a window on the truth. They're a user interface that evolution has shaped. Space-time is your desktop, but it's a three-dimensional desktop, and physical objects are just icons. So a tree, the moon, the sun, the neurons that we see when we look inside of brains through microscopes, these are just icons that we create. They're data structures from a computer science point of view. These are data structures that we create on the fly to represent fitness payoffs and how we might obtain them. And as soon as we don't need them, we garbage collect them. I see a cup or an apple. That's a data structure that I create that tells me how I might grab some fitness payoffs that might help me. And as soon as I look somewhere else, I garbage collect those data structures. I throw them away and I create new data structures. So physical objects aren't these pre-existing entities that always are there. even if no creatures observe. Rather, they're data structures that we create on the fly and destroy, or you know, throw away as soon as we don't need them, and that includes neurons. So the idea that consciousness derives from neural activity then has to be turned on its head. It's rather that space, time, and physical objects derive from consciousness as a user interface that conscious agents create and use to interact with. Well, now the question is, what is the reality that we're interacting with, right? I mean, if it's not space, time, and matter, what is that objective reality? And of course, the proper answer is, I don't know. But as a scientist, I'm going to propose something and we'll see whether it's right or not, right? The idea is to be precise so you can find out precisely why you're wrong. And so what I'm proposing is that objective reality is a vast social network of conscious agents. So not just human consciousnesses, but cat consciousnesses, ant consciousnesses, and then untold varieties, of other kinds of consciousness that we've never encountered before. So it's a vast social network of conscious agents where I have a mathematical model with some colleagues that we've published on this. So it's not just an abstract idea. We have a mathematical model. I'm very sorry. I've got it.
No, it's fine.
So the idea then is that there's this huge social network. Think of it like Twitter, right? There is this network of various agents tweeting and following and ideas that are trending and so forth. And each of us is a conscious agent. And each of us is, in fact, made of many, an infinite lattice of conscious agents. You're not just one conscious agent, but a whole lattice of conscious agents as well. But as each of us, as a conscious agent, has limited resources, and we're dealing with this infinite social network of conscious agents, and it's overwhelming. It's just too much, right? If you were trying to understand everything that's happening, all the billions of tweets that are going on right now, and who's tweeting to whom, and who's following whom, it would be overwhelming to understand what's really going on. So we need visualization tools, and we see this with big data all the time right now. That Google and Facebook and all these companies devise visualization tools that help them understand how these big social networks are operating. And that's what we've done. Space, time, and physical objects are not the objective reality. They're just our visualization tool. It's the visualization tool that some conscious agents, Homo sapiens, our species, uses to simplify and deal with this vast social network of conscious agents. Otherwise, we'd be overwhelmed by it.
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating. And I want to try and touch base on a few things that you described there and kind of put it into my own sort of geeky layman's terms.
Sure.
And so when I brought up the example of if the tree falls in the forest and no one is around to hear it, then in reality the forest didn't even exist to begin with. The tree didn't exist. The way that I see that, if we were going to kind of use an analogy of some, like the way that I see things, is that we are living in a virtual reality game, very similar to the film Ready Player One. I don't know if you've seen that or if anyone who's listening has seen that. And it is spiritually powered in that our consciousness is plugged into the avatar in which we reside in. And just like you would do on a video game, the consciousness emanates out of the power of the console, the video game. And you can, like, if you're just say you're playing on an open world RPG, online RPG, mm-hmm. the world renders as you transverse the plane of existence. So it's not there until you're there, if that makes sense. If that's kind of playing what you're saying, is the same as we perceive reality. And the only way, so if there was no one else on Earth except for you, the America would only exist if I flew to America. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. So I think that analogy is very, very apt to what I'm saying here, and it seems to fit in with what evolution by natural selection is telling us, that space-time as you perceive it and physical objects are just basically your virtual reality. We all have a headset on. We don't know it. It's hard for us to imagine it, but this is, we have a headset on and we're creating this stuff on the fly. So when I look up and I see the moon that I experience is something that I'm creating on the fly. That moon that I perceive, it doesn't exist until I perceive it. Now, there is something that does exist independent of me. But that thing that exists independent of me is not the moon, and it's not anything inside space and time. I'm proposing that, that what that is this vast social network of interacting conscious agent. That's what really exists independent of me. And even if I weren't interacting with it, that network would continue. So I'm not what's called a solipsist. A solipsist is someone who says the only thing that exists in all of reality is just me and my perceptions. I'm not saying that. I believe, for example, that your consciousness right now exists even if mine didn't. So you're conscious, and I believe that you have consciousness. And anybody listening to this, I would say their consciousness exists and does not depend on my consciousness for their own existence. However, my perception of you, when I perceive your face and your body, everything that I perceive of you, that's my icon that I'm constructing. So when I see your face, I'm not really seeing your consciousness. I'm seeing my own little graphic symbol. If I see that, you know, your face smile, I infer that there's your consciousness behind that face symbol that's happy. I mean, I could be wrong, but that's what I, and if you frown, I assume that your consciousness might be unhappy. There's no resemblance between a smile and the conscious experience of happiness. They don't resemble each other. But I do know that whenever I see you smile, that's an indication that I should probably infer that your consciousness is maybe experiencing happiness. And so the idea is that our space-time interface with objects, like human bodies and faces and cats and ants and amoebas and so forth, that interface is a visualization tool that we've evolved to allow us to interact with this pre-existing world of conscious agents that's infinitely complicated and would overwhelm us if we didn't have a visualization tool. And it's not, so I'm not saying that, for example, strictly speaking, when I see you, the face and body that I see is not conscious. That's just my symbol. You know, I am conscious of that symbol that I'm creating. I'm creating your face and body that I perceive. Strictly speaking, the face and body that I perceive is not itself conscious. It's a pointer that I have. It's a symbol that I have to a consciousness that would exist even if I never created your face and body as my icon. So that's just my window. I have a little portal into your consciousness, and you have a little portal into my consciousness. You have, I think probably a fallible but true insight into some aspects of my conscious experiences. But we know firsthand that how rich our own conscious experiences are. They're incredibly rich. Our hopes, our desires, our aspirations, our fears, our joys, our love of music, our politics, all this rich realm of conscious experiences, I assume you have it. My interface, my portal into your consciousness gives me very, very little insight into that. In fact, I just see skin, hair, and eyes. That's all I literally see. But behind that, I believe, is this vast world of your conscious experiences. When I look at what I call my cat, again, my cat symbol is strictly speaking just my symbol. That's not conscious. But nevertheless, that cat symbol, my icon of a cat that I perceive, is a genuine portal into a realm of consciousness that I have less insight into. I think I can, you know, if my cat purrs when I pet it, I suspect that the cat is feeling some kind of pleasure. And if it, you know, if it's growling or something like that when another cat comes at it, then I suspect that its conscious experience is not pleasurable, that it's angry or something. When I see an ant, my symbols are now giving me a very, very poor portal into the consciousness on the other side. I mean, I have no idea what to infer about the conscious experiences of an ant. With an amoeba, I've completely given up. I have no idea. Mm-hmm. And that's no surprise, because I have a finite capacity. And yet it's an infinite network of conscious agents that I'm dealing with, but I have a finite interface, a finite visualization tool. So there'll be certain parts of my visualization tool that give me my best insights into consciousness, namely when I interact with people and I see their faces and bodies. That's probably my best portal into the realm of consciousness. But from there, it goes down. My portal into cats is very, very poor. Into ants, it's terrible. And I have to give up. But that's no surprise. I have a finite interface. I have to give up with a finite interface when I'm dealing with an infinite realm of conscious agents. Of course, I have to give up. So my interface will give me less and less and less insight into the realm of the conscious agents that I'm interacting with. So that's going to be a necessary limitation of my interface just because it's finite. But what we do as a species is we take this necessary limit of our interface, that it gives us less and less insight into the consciousnesses that we're interacting with. We take that limit as an insight into the nature of reality. We assume that because as we look at things more and more microscopically, we have less and less evidence of consciousness, we take that as evidence that there is no consciousness. So we reify our limits. We say, because our interface is showing us less and less about consciousness, therefore that means in fact the fundamental nature of reality is that it's not conscious. It's only complicated systems that have consciousness. So that's just an elementary mistake. It's like someone looking at the desktop on their computer and saying, well, if you look really, really closely, you know, it's made out of pixels, and so that's the final reality. Pixels are the final reality. Well, no, that's just, you know, a feature of your interface. It's not the truth.
Yeah, and again, everything you're saying ties in so nicely to, like, my other research into, like, ancient traditions, ancient cultures. You had the Vedic Valley that discussed the idea of the Maya, which is mm-hmm. the great illusion. You've got the ancient right. Gnostics, which were the early Christians, and they believed in the Pleroma, which was like a realm beyond ours, behind this sort of veil of the physical reality that we perceive. And yeah, it just, everything just really, really ties together nicely with how the way that you're talking about conscious agents is the way that I see it. Is like in this virtual reality game that we're in, like us, you are player one, like you are the main player, and then you've in RPGs you have NPCs, which are non-playable characters, and mm-hmm. those are going to be the other conscious agents. So you in my life, you're an NPC. I can't play as you, but right. you're still written from the same source code as I am. We're all still part of the same overarching code. It's just that I'm experiencing the game through my consciousness and you're experiencing it through yours. But and there's it's interesting because when we're making these games, obviously, again, this you can go deeper into this even more and say that this is just a entry level of what we're eventually going to create when technology allows us to, which is to recreate this again over and over and over. If you're going off taking into account, like, is it Moore's law and Kurzweil's law of accelerating returns and the acceleration of the technological advances, and that we're going to have quantum computing that would be able yeah. to create universes indistinguishable from this on a desktop in maybe in as years advance in maybe on the latest mobile phone, maybe not even the top of the range, maybe some budget phone would be able to do the exact same, and we'll be able to have the computing power to create a reality just like this. And it's very sort of like mind fucking in terms of like the potential that we could be living in a simulation right now. And I know that's a thought that you've got like Elon Musk is brought that up in his own sort of yeah. in his own little philosophy of life. You've got Nick Bostrom, you've got I believe as well that is it Professor James Gates, I've heard that you've discussed him as well, and he found like these error correcting codes within his supersymmetry theory. Is that correct?
That's right. I wouldn't want to say that Gates is endorsing anything that I say. I mean, he's on his own
little path as well. Yeah,
that's right. He's his own person, and I wouldn't want to say that he's endorsing me in any way. But I would say that the kinds of things that he's finding in terms of error correcting codes in space-time is something that I would I think is very, very interesting and very, very compatible with what I'm saying. That space-time itself is not a fundamental reality. It's a data structure that we create, and is probably a data compressing, error correcting code that we use as a visualization tool for this vast social network of conscious agents. And there are other physicists who are saying something similar. They're not talking about the field of conscious agents. So I'm not claiming that these physicists are talking about, you know, the vast social network of conscious agents. They're not. But they are saying things like space-time is doomed. And that's a quote, space-time is doomed. Nima Arkani-Hamed at the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton. And several others have said the very, very same thing. And their idea is that in some sense, we have to let go of space-time being fundamental if we're to get general relativity and quantum field theory to work together, to get a deeper theory in which the two are united. Space-time cannot be fundamental. It has to emerge from something deeper. David Gross has said this, and Ed Witten as well. I blanked on their names there for a minute, but Ed Witten and David Gross, other major physicists are saying the same kind of thing as Nima Arkani-Hamed. So what I'm proposing, and this is now where I the physicists are not on board. I'm proposing that what's deeper than space-time is this vast social network of conscious agents, and that space-time in physics is simply a visualization tool that a certain set of conscious agents that we call Homo sapiens happens to use. But you'd mentioned earlier the relationship between certain spiritual traditions and this idea, and I think that that's a point that's worth discussing for a moment. In some sense, I agree there are religious traditions and spiritual traditions that have had the notion that space, time, and matter are not the final reality, that there's something beyond, and that's a common theme to many religious approaches or spiritual approaches. And that's something that's been denied by much of modern science. But now that scientists, physicists in particular, are saying that space-time is doomed, the fundamental framework that we've assumed in science as being the foundational reality is being let go, and they don't know what to replace it with. This is the kind of thing that many in spiritual traditions would say, of course. Now the physicists have not yet figured out what they want to replace it with. So they're definitely not yet saying that they're on board with anything that spiritual traditions have talked about. But I think that there could be an interesting dovetailing between science and spirituality in the following sense. I think that the spiritual idea that in some sense consciousness is fundamental is deeply right. But I think that the scientific method is a deeply right method. That science, I think that science, its physicalism has been a useful tool, assuming that space, time, and matter are fundamental, has been a useful tool for several centuries. It's really been a great framework for a lot of good science for several centuries. We've now realized that we've ridden that horse, it's done a good job, and it's time to change horses. We just don't know what the new horse is going to be. Science is not a theory or any particular set of theories. Science is a method of inquiry. That method of inquiry is fabulous. It's the best method that we have for understanding. But the theory of physicalism, that space, time, and matter are fundamental, that particular theory is not necessary to science, and I think that science is in the process of recognizing that and throwing it away. This opens the possibility of taking some of the ideas that have been around from long spiritual traditions, that somehow consciousness might be fundamental, dust off those theories, make them rigorous, right? The problem with the spiritual traditions have been that they're not precise. Right, there's not been any mathematical models, and so in some sense, even though their intuitions might be good, we spin our wheels for centuries, not making any progress because you can't just have intuitions. You need to make them precise so that you can actually see where your intuitions lead, to make precise predictions and make your intuitions so precise that you can figure out where they're wrong. I mean, I think one big reason for using mathematics is that way, when you state your ideas with mathematical precision, you make your ideas vulnerable to being shown wrong. And that's the whole goal. It's not to prove that I'm right, it's to find out as quickly as possible where I'm wrong. Mm. And if we have that attitude of not trying to prove what we already knew, but rather we have these ideas, we may like our ideas, but we need to be open to the possibility that they're wrong, and we need to be open and willing to have them be shown wrong as quickly as possible so that we can move on and evolve our ideas in a better way. So the hope I have is to bring the rigor of precision from science into the very interesting ideas of the spiritual traditions so that we can get out of a rut and actually start to make progress. Find out which ideas work, which ones are just flat out wrong, and actually have what you might call a scientific spirituality, where we're literally doing theorems and proofs and empirical tests. These are the biggest and most important questions of human existence. You know, who are we? Why are we here? What is this all about? Why wouldn't we use the best method of inquiry that we've ever discovered, namely the scientific method and the precision of mathematics, to try to address the most important questions we have? One objection that people have had is to say that, quoting, for example, the prophet Rumi, who said something like, the language of God is silence, all else is poor translation. And you know, one way to take that statement is to say, you know, the scientists were, with all their mathematics and so forth, are off on a fool's errand, because that's all jabber, that's all talk. The language of God, on the other hand, is silence. And so all this scientific stuff is just missing the point. True spirituality is only in silence. And I absolutely respect a mystic or a spiritual person who says that, and then, being entirely consistent, says absolutely nothing further. And that's not a joke. I would actually very much respect that. If someone says, the language of God is silence, all else is poor translation, and then refuses to say anything more about God, mm-hmm. about the nature of reality, and just says, go into silence and there you will meet it, I respect that. But that's not what the spiritual traditions do. They write thousands upon thousands of words, and we collect them, and we've had them for thousands of years. In that case, if we're going to go beyond silence, then there's something about human nature that we have to take into account. We are easily self-deceived, and we have what scientists call a confirmation bias. We tend to try to favor evidence that seems to support what we already believe. Mm-hmm. This is just part of human nature. That confirmation bias gets in the way of honest inquiry. So the goal of science, in some sense, is to be absolutely precise and to pit different people with different ideas, precisely stated, against each other so that they can have arguments. And I may try to just prove my point of view, and the other scientist may try to prove her point of view. But since we disagree, we get around this confirmation bias, because the other person is biased against my point of view. So that way we can have a genuine argument and begin, and using mathematical precision, I can say precisely where I think that theory is wrong, and they can say precisely where they think my theory is wrong. That's how we make progress. So again, I would respect a person who says that whole thing is beside the point. Silence is the start and end of any spiritual quest. If someone says that and is consistent, hats off, I have no contradiction. But as soon as someone says, no, let's talk further, then I say, okay, if we're going to talk further, then we need to understand that there are all sorts of biases within human nature. We need to be precise and try to avoid confirmation bias, and try to have the attitude of, these ideas are just ideas, they're not the truth. Let's try to find out where my ideas are wrong as quickly as possible. So I'll try to be precise and say what you could do to show that my ideas are wrong as quickly as possible so that we don't spin our wheels wasting our time just defending silly positions because our egos are involved. And so that's where I think the scientific method, combined with some of the insights from spiritual traditions, can be very, very valuable. And of course, I expect that some of the quote-unquote insights from spiritual traditions will also be falsified. They'll shown to be not insights. And so that's what science does. We'll find what are the insights or what are close to insights and evolve those into new and more rich theories. One thing I'd say about this is that it's quite interesting that the theories that scientists write down, the best theories, end up being, in some sense, smarter than the scientist that wrote it down. One of my favorite examples of that is Einstein. Maybe partly because who was ever smarter than Einstein? Maybe Newton, but beyond that, you know, not too many people would want to be framed as smarter than Einstein. Einstein spent many, many years taking his intuitions and crafting his intuitions about gravity into an equation, general relativity, which he published around 1915. And that equation captured years and years of his difficult quest, his search to take his intuitions and capture precisely what he thought might be the nature of gravity. And so he wrote down the equations of general relativity, which have not been superseded to this day, more than a century later, in terms of our understanding of gravity. Fabulous. What Einstein didn't know was that his equations entailed the existence of black holes. He had no idea. And when someone pointed that out, he was appalled, and he thought that black holes did not exist. And that's the power of taking our intuitions and writing them down precisely, because in some sense, we're not smart enough to see all the implications of our intuitions. We can only see so far. Our intuitions only take us so far. When we write them down precisely, then all of a sudden, we find out all sorts of implications that we didn't know. And I would love to see that brought to spiritual traditions. We have these intuitions, and I think many of them may be very, very good. They may be close to actual truths for all we know. Let's write them down precisely, because then we get this cognitive lever, this ability to take our intuitions and amplify them and see where they lead us and make clean predictions. And so that's what I would hope. Eventually, this beautiful interaction that's possible between the scientific method of precise inquiry and making predictions that can be falsified, and then some of these intuitions that are not physicalist intuitions from the spiritual traditions. And science seems to be getting ready to let go of space-time when they say space-time is doomed. I'll be interested to see where they go. Will they be willing to think about consciousness being fundamental? Maybe not until we can get a mathematically precise theory of consciousness that can show how space, time, and matter precisely come out as a visualization tool. And that's the goal that I have with my colleagues that I'm working with, Chetan Prakash and Federico Fajin and Chris Fields and Manish Singh and Mauro Dariano and Robert Prentner. We're working to show that we can get back space-time physics like general relativity, quantum field theory, and evolution by natural selection as visualizations of the dynamics of this vast social network of interacting conscious agents.
Is it going to be possible to create a equation for consciousness if consciousness is believed to be infinite and all that there is?
I have not an equation, but a mathematical model for consciousness, which I've published. It was published in Frontiers of Psychology in 2014. It's called Objects of Consciousness. So if you looked up, Googled the paper Objects of Consciousness by Donald Hoffman, you could go directly to my paper that gives a mathematical model of consciousness, and it's free. So anybody can pick it up free online, Objects of Consciousness. And that model is mathematically precise. I'm probably wrong. I would just put that right out there. But I'm absolutely precise so that someone who thinks that the model is wrong can then say precisely what part of the mathematics they think is wrong. That's how we get this science game going, is to have a precise model on the table. Of course it's wrong. None of our scientific theories, I believe, are correct. Even general relativity and quantum field theory, we know, as powerful, as beautiful, as deep, as insightful as they are, as many experiments as they've have confirmed them, we suspect that they're deeply wrong. There's some deeper insight and some deeper theory that's going to transcend those theories. And so I don't think that any of our scientific theories are yet true, although I do think it is the goal of science to come up with true theories. I don't think we've done it yet. I think that we've gotten very beautiful and deep theories that we need to study, because they're the best tools we have so far. And so that's the way I view my theory of consciousness. It's just a tool that we have right now. It's a precise theory. And it does allow me to make predictions about the dynamics of this network of conscious agents, and to make predictions, for example, that when two conscious agents interact, they can create a new conscious agent, a new single conscious agent. And this process of combining agents can go on ad infinitum. You could create, you know, new levels of consciousness by combining conscious agents, even to the point where you get infinite consciousnesses. So once again, I'm into the realm of spirituality. When you start talking about infinite consciousnesses, that's the kind of thing that many spiritual traditions would be talking about. But I have a mathematically precise model of what I mean by infinite consciousnesses, and I can actually have theorems and proofs about them. How many of them are there? How many different kinds of infinite consciousnesses are there? How are finite consciousnesses related to them? Can finite consciousnesses know anything about the infinite ones? How much can they know? What are the limits of what a finite consciousness can know about the infinite consciousnesses in which it participates? Are these infinite consciousnesses omniscient, omnipotent, omnipresent, all, you know, some classical Christian kinds of questions about God? These are questions that we can now phrase as precise mathematical theorems about this mathematical structure, an infinite conscious agent. So, and again, it's not that this definition of consciousness is right, but it is precise. It makes precise predictions, and we can now start the process of testing it and modifying the mathematics precisely so that we can get the best answers that are humanly possible to the questions that matter most to us. Who are we? Why are we here? And what is this all about?
Yeah, it's interesting, again, just piecing all this together in my mind as you're talking about it, saying how we transitioned from a time period in which the world was seen through a religious lens, and then we then sort of, yeah, transitioned into the new sort of how we see the modern world through a very scientific lens, which would be very left brain orientated, very analytical, very logical, very rational. And maybe now what we're transitioning into is the sort of alchemical marriage of the left and right brain, which is going to be the religion, the spiritual, and the science. And from there, a new paradigm will be created and given birth to through that. And I feel like it's going to be very similar to almost how we lived in. For me, like, everything is cyclical, and our ancestors in the ancient past are us in the future. That's what I believe in terms of what we're headed, where we're heading in terms of our viewpoint, our views, and the way we're going to see the world is going to sort of go full circle into seeing the world as they did. And one of the things that obviously a lot of spiritual beliefs are centered around is all to do with the process of self-actualization, mm-hmm. of knowing thyself. And one thing that I've heard you say before, now I don't want to butcher this and completely get the wrong idea of what you were trying to say, is that it's impossible to fully know yourself, because in order to fully know yourself, you have to self-replicate you, but you can't self-replicate you if you don't know yourself in the first place. So the self-replication is going to be not 100%
correct? Is that something around those lines? I mean, that's me coming from my monkey brain trying to break down what I heard you say, and I was just like, man, that's mind-blowing. And then I was wondering if you could give us a rundown of what you actually meant without me butchering it.
Oh, you're very, very close. Any finite system that tries to build a model of itself so that it can sort of completely understand itself, in the very process of building a model, it becomes more complicated. So now, to understand the new self with that model, you have to build a more complicated model, but now you've become more complicated. And so this is a never-ending cycle. You can represent yourself partly, but you can never represent yourself completely. So you can never completely understand yourself. And that's an interesting just mathematical fact about any finite system. It can't fully build a model of itself. And so our knowledge of ourselves will necessarily be incomplete. And my own view is that from the view of conscious agents, I am a single conscious agent, but I'm also two conscious agents. And perhaps the difference between our left hemispheres and right hemispheres maps onto that difference between those two conscious agents. But then the theory of conscious agents that I'm working on predicts that, in fact, I'm an infinite lattice of conscious agents that goes all the way down to very simple conscious agents that are what I call one-bit agents. They literally have one bit of perception. They can only see, like, you know, two different kinds of conscious experiences and have very primitive set of actions.
Would that be like the bacteria in cellular forms?
Well, bacteria are probably still pretty high up. They're probably, you know, they're probably trillions, quadrillions of conscious agents.
Wow.
that we're interacting with there. These one-bit conscious agents are incredibly austere in terms of their perceptual worlds. But when they combine, they create 4-bit agents and then 8-bit agents, 16-bit agents, all the way up to however many bits we might be. And so when I try to represent with my visualization tool, this gets into your self-representation thing. So I'm trying to represent the world of conscious agents out there, this vast social network, including all the social, the network that constitutes what I call my instantiation, all the agents that combine to form me. So that's what I call my instantiation. So it's a subset of this huge social network of conscious agents. So when I use my space and time visualization tool to represent the whole network of conscious agents, including my instantiation, I represent my instantiation as my body. That's how I compress those conscious agents into my visualization tool. That's my body. Higher levels, I view of my instantiation of in terms of conscious agents, I view them as my psychological states, my moods and my feelings. A little bit lower levels, I represent as my neural activity. A little bit below that, my biochemistry, and below that, my physics. In other words, as I look at my body more and more microscopically, I'm looking at my instantiation. It's my visualization tool being applied to the conscious agents that together form me. And that's what I call my body. So my body isn't the truth. When I look at my hands and see them moving, I don't know what I'm really doing in objective reality. All I know is what my visualization tool allows me to see about what I'm doing in objective reality, which may not be very much. We may have really very little insight into what we're actually doing in objective reality, and also as to who we really are. So that gets at the self-representation thing. We only know ourselves under description. And my very definition of conscious agent, for better or for worse, does not require a conscious agent to even have a self. This theory predicts that there are conscious agents with no notion of a self. A self is a symbol that certain conscious agents build to represent a subset of their own perceptions and actions. But that self is just another icon on the interface. It's not the objective reality. So it's humbling. It means that even my own knowledge of myself is under a description. That's why perhaps we are mysteries to ourselves. There's a lot more to us than our perceptions allow us to see. And we may not be able to get there except through using mathematical models to ask ourselves, okay, what possibly is this network of, you know, conscious agents like? Can I use that model to get a better idea about what I really am, and so forth? We'll see how far we can go.
Man, Don, it's everything you're saying is just like it's so much how I view the world, but just within you articulate it so much better than how I can visualize it in my mind, and it's so fascinating. So with the, just to sort of tie things up, because I know I only had you for an hour, which was kind of wish I had a little bit more, just to really pick your brains on this. What is the best evidence that we know of in today's theoretical science or accepted science, depending on what one you want to sort of angle you want to take this, that we are living in, which what could be essentially described as some form of virtual reality or simulation?
I think one very interesting result or discovery in physics points in that direction, and it's called the holographic principle. Mm-hmm. If I ask you how much information could you pack inside a volleyball? You might say, well, I could stick a 5 terabyte hard drive in there, and next year maybe a 10 terabyte hard drive. We ask the question, well, is there an in principle limit? Is there some maximum amount of information that you could stick inside that volleyball? And it turns out Stephen Hawking answered that question. He proved that there is a limit, and it depends not on the volume of the region of space, not on the volume of the volleyball, but on its surface area. In some sense, you cannot store information into volumes of space. It doesn't work. And physicists are now convinced that this is an important and central principle. They don't know yet what it means. This is fairly new. It's in the last few decades. And the holographic principle is now widely accepted, and they're trying to figure out what this is telling us about the nature of objective reality. What I suggest it's telling us is that space-time is just a data structure, and it's not the pre-existing stage on which the drama of life plays out. It's a data structure that we employ as visualization tool. So it's not an objective reality independent of us. It's our creation. We're not a product of processes inside space and time. We didn't evolve out of impersonal processes inside a pre-existing space and time. To the contrary, space-time is something that you create right now in the moment. It's your data structure. You are the author of space-time. You are not a tiny little speck, insignificant speck inside this vast space-time that was already there. Quite the opposite. You create space-time right here and now. You're the author of it. You transcend space and time. And the holographic principle, again, I'm not saying that physicists themselves are endorsing what I'm saying here. I wouldn't claim that at all. But you did ask what I thought was some good evidence in that direction. From my point of view, I think the holographic principle will end up pushing us into this new understanding of space-time as a data structure that we create.
So am I right in thinking the way that you described it then, if that information can't be stored in volume, like you're saying, and it can only be stored on a surface area, is that the same to relate to like playing a Blu-ray disc? On the surface of the Blu-ray disc, that's where the information is stored, and then the light that's refracted off that is what creates the image we see on the screen.
That's the kind of metaphor that the physicists are using. That it's like with a hologram, right? You can have just a two-dimensional film and the right laser setup, and all of a sudden you'll see a three-dimensional object, holographically. That's what this is. They're saying that this whole three-dimensional world that what we perceive could just be a holographic projection of a two-dimensional film at the vast edges of the universe. How it's written, what language is written, where it's written, they have no idea. So there's still, there's huge questions that the physicists themselves are having to deal with. They don't know what language is written in and so forth, but quantum bits or something like that.
That is fascinating, because then it's like if it was on like a 2D plane, that then connects again with certain esoteric beliefs of planes of existence, in that dimensions are differentiated through planes of vibration, and that would then affect the holographic representation of the dimension that we're perceiving. Wow.
Yeah,
that's
quite a connection, quite possible. Eventually we might make that kind of connection very rigorously. We'll see.
Yeah. There's so fascinating. It just shows that there's so much that we don't know, and there's so much that we don't know that we don't know.
Exactly.
And yeah, we're continuously just, it's a weird trait that humans have. There's always seems to be a percentage anyway that are truth seekers, and and that's what I love about your work and the others within this field, is that they're not necessarily being controlled by, or let's say, held back by preconceived ideas and ideologies, is that they are following truth. And the scientific model, when used honestly, it can lead you to indefinite truth for sure. And I'm really excited to see where everything goes from here. We're at a very interesting stage in being humans here on planet Earth, living in the Matrix, which we do. I think we're in for some big revelations coming up soon.
Absolutely.
And just to tie this one up now, then, Don, because I've had you for an hour and I appreciate your time and respect it. So for everyone that's really enjoyed what you've had to say, or even just were just like, fuck, man, geez, I need to listen some more of Don. I know you've got a new book coming out in August.
Yes.
And also, before you say that, so we've got the new book coming out in August. Also, where else can people find you? If it be your website, have you got any sort of channels that people can tune into you on the internet? And we kind of hit all the birds with one stone.
Well, thank you. Yes, I do have a book coming out. It's called The Case Against Reality. Mm-hmm. The Case Against Reality. It's going to be published by Norton in the United States. It's actually coming out in the UK with Penguin. So Penguin is publishing it in the UK. And so this is titled The Case Against Reality. The subtitle is Why Evolution Hid the Truth from Our Eyes. So there I make the argument from evolution that we're not seeing the truth. This is all just an interface. And then in the last chapter, I address the question, well, if this isn't the truth, what is? And I propose the idea of conscious agents. But that's going to be another book. The book on consciousness is another one that I'll be working on for a couple years down the road. I have a website. If you just Google Donald Hoffman, Hoffman, my homepage is one of the first pages that comes up. So it's and all of my papers and podcasts and videos are listed there under my Vita. So I've got a link to my Vita, and it's got everything with links to free online sources in many cases. And I also have a Twitter feed where I announce recent ideas and so forth. Or it's, I think it's at Donald D. Hoffman.
Okay.
At Donald D. Hoffman, Hoffman, is my Twitter. So I don't overdo it, but every few days or so, I'll put out some new idea or yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I'll throw that all into the show notes as well. And hopefully people will really appreciate the work that you're putting in and how revolutionary this can be when it comes to full realization of what you're actually putting forth. The models that you're putting forth are game changing, quite literally game changing, in changing the simulation that we're in. So
thank you very much, Chris.
Again, thank you for coming on, Donald. It was great to really have you on, and just for you to give me some of your time to really sort of scratch the surface and just kind of view the tip of the iceberg of what I know this subject is. I really did enjoy it, and hopefully everyone that's tuned in had a good time as well, and kind of understood as much as we could for the level we're at. But it's all part of the show, and this is what I want. I want to be able to have experts on like yourself in order to break down complex models of reality of different ways of thinking so that people that are listening can, well, it can almost plant a seed in their brain, which can then sort of maybe grow into and blossom into something much more if they wish to pursue it afterwards. And yeah, like you said, you've got so much work that's been published, papers that they can read. And for people that are interested, guys, check out Professor Hoffman's work. And I think you'll definitely be taking a trip down a few rabbit holes in the process. And yeah, you never know where you'll come out, what side of the rabbit hole you're going to fall out of. So yeah, with that said, let's call this one a night. So that's episode 36 of the Red Pill Initiation Hour. Guys, as always, stay woke as fuck, and I'll catch you on the next episode.